I'm backstage at Salmon Arms Roots and Blues with Sean and Matt of the Harpoonist and the Axe Murderer, who just came off a like totally ridiculously awesome set workshop just a few minutes ago on the blues stage, and also a great performance last night on the barn stage. Thanks for joining me for Indie Beat.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Can you tell me a little about your really early musical histories? Did you grow up in musical families?
I grew up in a pretty musical, sort of not. They're all like teachers. But my folks lived in Africa in the late 60s in West Africa and the early 70s in East Africa, and they had this incredible drum collection and like Lokembe's like thumb pianos, and they used to throw ridiculous parties in like Parkdale, Toronto in the early 80s, and that was probably the first influence of like, I mean like till 5 in the morning, and I would come downstairs and go like, shut up! And they'd be smoking all the weeds and all that stuff, and that was like my first introduction to like just I guess rhythm and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, my father was a rock drummer, so he introduced me to a lot of, you know, blues and rock that I really got into strongly in my early teens. And my mother was a classical pianist. And her mother was a very accomplished classical pianist/teacher. So that sort of gave me a bit more of the sort of like the theoretical musical background of things.
Do either of you remember what the very first record you ever bought for yourself was, no matter how embarrassing it might be?
Mine's awesome. My very first record that I bought on tape, I went to the record store and bought Led Zeppelin 4.
Oh,
and
nice.
I will always be proud of that. This is a very good choice.
It was a very good choice.
Still the album that I will listen to that album to the day I die. Maybe stopping at Stairway to Heaven.
No, because Stairway to Heaven was recorded on Studio One Basing Street. Chris Blackwell's. And that's like, Stairway to Heaven, I think, has gone around the world so many times in my brain, and everyone's collect. It is so freaking cool.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything remotely not cool about that tune. Just don't try to
Except
cover it.
Except that it's overplayed, but that's about it.
Yeah. My first record is absolutely not cool. And as John Travolta did a follow-up to Saturday Night Fever, and the film was called Staying Alive, and that's the record I bought. And it was an edited version of Staying Alive on the film, but it was him in the early 80s with spandex, and it was really not a good record. But that was my first record.
Quite a dichotomy between the two of you, for sure. How did the two of you come together, find each other, and become the band?
Tinder. early beta versions of Tinder. In the early 2000s. No, we met through a mutual friend, a great musician, and Sean had me play guitar on an ad that he was doing, I guess a jingle,
yeah.
A radio jingle that he was doing for a Jamaican pizza restaurant, and he and our mutual friend were I guess you guys were writing radio jingles or something at the time.
Oh god. And we took a stab at like a fake Tampax commercial. If I remember it, I'll share it with you later, but definitely not for public consumption. No, now that I remembered it, I would never repeat it. But we put together a demo reel and we were, oh god. I'll tell it to you later. It was like HB. Like that's. I won't even sing it. But we were putting together a demo reel, and one of them was a real pitch, for a real restaurant owned by a Jamaican dude that made pizza, and I didn't even meet Matt then.
Like, yeah.
He was working with this funk band. You were working with Amalia Townsend, right?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. And funk band at the time.
It's like
Chaka
Khan funk
band.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
How did you approach your songwriting together? Is it super collaborative, or do you like totally bring each other stuff that's almost finished and then just tweak it, or?
That would be easy.
That would be easy. I think we always seem to take the most difficult approach.
but
songwriting is like, you know, you're chasing something always, and you never know what you're chasing. So it's a difficult beast to tame. So I think we've tried everything, and we still will try probably everything else, including probably like, you know, doing acid and going up into the wilderness and seeing what we come up with, which will probably be nothing.
No, that's not true. Doing acid's making a good comeback. I did a half a tab of acid last spring, and while my neighbor, the new neighbor in the backyard adjacent to mine, directly behind mine, directly behind the alleyway is what I'm trying to say, sat on the back porch on acid while the biggest tree in the neighborhood got taken down in front of me, and it was devastating to my heart and soul. And I was writing a song, and I didn't write like a Bruce Coburn, like, if a tree falls in a Nanaimo, nobody cares. Like, nothing came of it. But acid's it's a great tool in small doses.
All right. So for the next album, that's what we're going to do.
Just don't name your record Small Doses, because that's weak.
You released your debut record in 2008, your most recent, Apocalyptic, another great name. And I made a point not to ask you about your band name, although it's so cool. But, you know, I know you're tired of that. So, but another great name with Apocalyptic. How do you feel your sound's evolved with the newer record?
I think with the newer record, we wanted to just go a little more, maybe a little more basic rock and roll.
Did we?
But... and speaking of acid, a little more psychedelic.
Yeah.
Just sort of psychedelic rock and roll. We didn't want to feel like we had to make a blues record or anything. We wanted to just make the record that was the best songs that we happened to have lying around at that time. So I don't know if that answers how our sounds evolved. Evolving is sort of a thing that you do by nature, not always by sort of consciously doing it.
Yeah, I think, like, if I can address that, Matthew, evolving when you consciously start doing it and you're like, I'm going to now introduce this piece of gear to my lineup, usually it doesn't always work. And you do a show, for me at least, I'll be like, all right, now I'm going to introduce like this thing that's going to do this and this and this to my sound. And then I go, oh God, I absolutely destroyed it. And then I insult it, and then insult myself on stage. I'm like, this sucks, and like, I'm never gonna throw it out. But if you absorb something, if you absorb something, do you evolve? I don't know. Evolving is where you really can't think about it.
Yeah, I don't think it has to be intentional.
Yeah.
It just sort of happens. But yeah, you may be able to look back and go, this is what happened.
You find your holes through the tapestry of life or something like that. You find places that you can place your colors to be more abstract and less like, you know. Yeah.
That's deep.
I just looked up at the sky for those listening on the radio when I said that. And I was like, tell me, God, what should I say now? And God's like, speak about the tapestry.
What can you tell me about your song, Pretty Please?
Ooh, it's really funny how that song came about, actually, specifically, because I wrote the little basic nugget of that song as an actual sort of serious love song, and it got totally bastardized, not bastardized in a good way, into a just sort of a lustful begging.
It completely,
and that's
wrong.
Great. It, you know, songs take on a life of their own, and that one took on a life of its own from the original conception of it.